Since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America. They fought to end slavery. They joined with allies to win two world wars. They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord. Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces. The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide at 1041thetruth.com. To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Good afternoon, Tucson. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome back to another fascinating episode of American Warrior. We're joined today by someone who's got 36 years of service to our country. And I encourage you, pick up the phone and call now, 751-1041. This gentleman is just a wealth of knowledge, has been involved with some of the most historic moments in our military history. Our guest today is General Earl T. O'Loughlin, who retired as the commander of the Air Force Logistics Command. He's been involved with bombing missions over North Korea. He's involved with Operation Arclight in Vietnam. Also some very intriguing missions that I just learned about, sir, when I was researching the program, some reconnaissance missions over the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Your resume, sir, is literally, five pages long here, so I don't want to spend all that much time on it. But suffice to say, the one thing that stood out, General, to me that I really, really appreciated was the fact that you were elected and presented with the coveted Order of the Sword, which I guess is one of the highest honor that enlisted personnel can present to one of their commanders. So, General O'Loughlin, welcome to American Warrior.
It's great to be here. Ben, thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure, and thank you for your service, sir.
Well, it's my pleasure. I had a great time.
You had a great time. And you're a temporary resident of Southern Arizona. You and your lovely wife live here part-time.
Right. We summer in Michigan in my home state, and then we started coming out here about 13 years ago.
So I'm guessing you're probably feeling pretty good about living in Tucson right now with what's happening back east.
From what's happening at home, yes.
Well, welcome to American Warriors. Let's start off with a little bit just about you and your background. I also found it interesting you began your career as an enlisted person and eventually rose up to the rank of general. Now, for those that are the uninitiated like myself, I know I got in a little bit of trouble with Lieutenant General Robin Rand because, and correct me if I'm wrong, one-star brigadier, two-star major general, three-star lieutenant general, but just general is four stars.
Right.
Okay, because I gave Robin a hard time. Said, Lieutenant General sounds like you're a general in training. That should be the one star. But you rose up, retired as a four-star general.
Yes, I did.
And tell us, at that point in time, how does one go? Because I would guess it's not all that common for an airman to end up as a four-star general. How did that work back in your era? And how did you get started?
General officers who start from enlisted are called Mustangs.
Okay.
And there's actually a museum in Alabama that honors Mustangs, that people have risen from the enlisted ranks. And we go through basic training, needs to say, and I had applied for pilot training ahead of time. So to get there, I had to go through the enlisted ranks.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't have made any difference. If I flunked out of pilot training, I probably would have stayed.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And yet you ended up with over 7,000 hours
right
in the cockpit. Now, folks, if you're, I've been told don't do math in public, but if you divide that up by a 24-hour day, you actually spent over 292 days in the cockpit of an aircraft defending our country.
Yes, and it was a thrill and a half.
And now you're principally a bomber pilot.
Right.
And what the range of aircraft that you flew over your career included?
I started out flying on T-6s in training, and then I graduated to the B-25 in Enid, Oklahoma. At that particular time, the T-28s were having engine problems, and as a result, they put us in T-28s, so we became multi-engined. And the Korean War was on, so my first assignment was the B-29 Eagle crew, and dispatched to after the training to Korea in the 98th Bomb Wing at Chakota. Japan. And it was an exciting time for a young first lieutenant.
Sure.
A new bride at home and being shot at is a new experience, but you get used to it after a while.
You know, they call the Korean War the Forgotten War, and in preparation for this interview, sir, I did a lot of reading and a lot of research. That was a very particularly the bomber campaign.
Right.
Very intriguing, given the politics involved in that particular conflict.
Especially, you couldn't fly too far north where you wanted to go. And a lot of people forget the fact that we lost 55,000 plus of America's finest in that war, even though it only lasted 3 years. And I think the country suffers as a whole when you take 55,000 young men out of the inventory.
And, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And not only that, but many of my friends who were imprisoned when they came back, unlike today, they had to stand a court-martial to clear themselves that they weren't contributing to the North Korean cause by having made statements.
Tell us more about that. Because my generation, I'm more familiar with the Vietnam War and the POWs there.
Well, it's completely different now. Walking them home as people home from as heroes now is something we long for in Korea and Vietnam. And I had several of my classmates, of course, get shot down, and they came back very bitter because they had to clear their name in order to be reinstated. And nowadays, of course, the follow-on to that was a revision in the what you could say.
Mm-hmm.
If you're being tortured to the extreme or you can't stand it, then you're allowed to say more than name, rank, serial number. But in those days, it was name, rank, serial number, and if you've deviated from that, then you're in trouble with your own government.
Now, did you, your sense from being involved in the thick of it, was there, at that point in history, was there still a little bit of war weariness coming out of the Second World War?
Yes, so there was in the fact that after each war, what we do is we de-arm.
Mm-hmm.
And we got out of World War II and we de-armed. And the aircraft that I flew, the B-29 I flew, came right out of the boneyard at San Bernardino, and it was rehabbed, and we flew it over there.
Now, the B-29, that was the brainchild of Hap Arnold, who, if you know anything about Air Force history, is quite the name there.
Yeah.
That was built, correct me if I'm wrong, to originally address the issue, the bombers we're using in the Second World War in Europe, given their range, were appropriate.
Right.
But Hap Arnold says, look, we're in the Pacific now. We need a different
longer
aircraft
range.
With a whole lot different capability.
And range is going to affect any operation that you have, especially now since we don't have the bases to launch on it.
Mm-hmm.
The Pacific, we really need some. That long range is very important.
And so as we entered into the Korean War, the original role of the B-29 was envisioned as what? As high-altitude bombing?
High-altitude conventional bombing.
Okay, but there weren't all that many targets in North Korea. I mean, your list was pretty short, wasn't it?
The list got short, and those that we did have within the confines of the North had been bombed over and over and over. And still in all, the resiliency of the enemy was quite evident when you got on a bomb run for a place that had been hit many times before.
You know, one thing I, as a fan of military history, I miss is nose art. And what your aircraft, your B-29, what was her name?
It was a nude lady on a donkey, and it was called Hauling.
Okay. No, don't make me press the button, General. Thank you. Folks, use your imagination. A donkey hauling. Okay. And that aircraft came out of, tell us, as civilians,
it came out of storage.
Okay.
And then, after the war, and was redone at the depot in San Bernardino. And it was in good shape. It was different than the ones we used out of Saipan Tinian during the World War II, because it had fuel injection rather than carburetors. The initial engine had a carburetor, which was quite prone to fire. The fuel injection resolved that.
And did that also have an impact on the performance at altitude?
It did, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And yeah. What is the tradition? You've got your crew that's assigned. Yeah. Here comes your aircraft. Do you all just sit around in a circle and dream up a name, or is that the commander's?
No, we actually inherited that name.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, there you go. Now, you flew 29 combat missions over North Korea. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that. Some of those missions. Was there one in particular that was hairy? Or
any time you went north to the bridges or along.
Yeah, go ahead and say it.
Anytime you went to the bridges along the Sinu and the Sinuaju and places like that, you could expect anything, including fighters. Down in the southern portion of North Korea, you might be surprised one night and when it was supposed to be predicted light flak, and you run into heavy stuff.
So okay.
It's unpredictable.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a short commercial break. This is American Warrior, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by General O'Loughlin, retired four-star general in the Air Force. If you'd like to call and ask him some questions, what a great resource we have here live in the studio, 751-1041. This is American Warrior. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined today live in the studio by General Earl O'Loughlin. Over 7,000 flying hours on the protection of our country. He's got a Distinguished Service Medal with one Oak Leaf Cluster, Legion of Merit, a Distinguished Flying Cross, which I think, sir, was the... Was that for your flight? So, yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that. Some intriguing stuff over the skies of Russia. A Bronze Star, Meritorious Service Medal, Air Medal, Air Force Commendation Medal with four Oak Leaf Clusters, on and on and on. 22 different types of aircraft. Before we took the break, General, we were talking a little bit about your experiences over the skies of North Korea as a bomber pilot. And we're just kind of talking about the difference in those missions. One of the things I found in research was initially, as I recall, initially pretty much your bombers had free reign of the skies. But then pretty soon some MiGs started coming up and anti-aircraft batteries. So what did that change take place during your time flying missions?
Or? The change took place because we went from daylight bombing to night.
Okay.
And we flew at night. The hazards at night were not only flak, but searchlights. But the searchlights, when the searchlights came on, then you knew the fighters were in the area. And the object was we had a radar man in the back who was to jam those signals that the searchlights were transmitting in and try to break lock if he was unlocked. Because if you're locked on five or six searchlights, in came a fighter.
And just so people know, these weren't just guys out there turning Klieg lights. The searchlights were radar-directed.
Radar
so
control.
They knew exactly where to look for you in the sky.
And that was the benefit of the ECM man in the back to jam those signals, which would make the searchlights just fall off randomly. If you were locked on and the jamming didn't take effect, then you could expect fighters. And usually they were firing a 2.7, 2.5 rocket. It would go by your nose, and then you'd know. But we took precautions. We flew course with no lights and turned the turbos down to where we had they couldn't silhouette us. But if they could silhouette you, then you were game for them. One evening, we had Marine A3Ds flying cap, but they were very slow. They didn't have. And then we got some F-94s that had afterburners, and they could accelerate. To if there was a situation where somebody got coned, and one night we were in the situation, the F-94 came through the bomber stream in his radar. He saw he was getting into the traffic, pulled up on our wing, and there was a Yak sitting there waiting to silhouette us, a Yak 23, and the next thing you know we saw an explosion. We thought we were hit because the airplane did suffer some turbulence, but then realized that he had blown up that Yak on our wing with it.
Now, the Yak is a Chinese aircraft or Russian?
It was Russian.
Russian, okay, a Russian fighter.
Russian Yak 23, yeah.
Now,
it was a prop driver. It's more like a P-51.
Okay, the original thought behind the B-29, was there ever thought to this would be an aircraft that would not require fighter escort or...
They use fighter escort far more in Japan. Yeah, they flew 51s out of Okinawa, and to cover the most of the B-29 raids over Japan.
Now, you were dropping conventional bombs?
500-pounders. Okay. Occasionally, if we were going after a dam or a thickly constructed concrete bunker of some type, we would use 1,000-2,000-pounders, yeah.
Now, in researching, I also saw that on occasion your aircraft were used to drop not bombs, but leaflets. Propaganda. Did you ever fly a propaganda mission?
No, I didn't.
Okay, was that...
The sister wing there dropped a lot of those.
Okay, as a pilot, as a warrior, did you find that insulting, or a job is a job and a mission
is
a mission?
Never faced it, but I wouldn't want to... It wouldn't be what... I'd rather drop bombs.
Well, there you go. That's the kind of honesty you can expect from our guest here, folks. Yeah. Don't forget, you can call in and ask questions, 751-1041. In retrospect, sir... You know, I think if you're not very well informed, we thought that the North Koreans had MiGs, but that the MiGs were being flown by North Korean pilots. And in retrospect, I think history has shown that that wasn't the case, that very often those were Russians that were flying those MiGs against
Russians
our crews.
And Chinese.
So these were experienced pilots. Yeah, they weren't.
Yeah. The chief of the Chinese Air Force, which I met in 1987, was shot down over North Korea. And at the same time, our chief at that time, General Charles Gabriel, got a MiG that day. Mm. And when they met for the first time, one of the first trips over there, when they opened us up where we could travel to China, they almost pinpointed the day that it was probably Charlie Gabriel who shot him down.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, I mean, there's another indicator of who was flying those airplanes.
Sure. These are serious pilots. Yeah. They weren't just draftees being put in the cockpit.
Right.
Now, I referenced some of the political challenges involved in that war, and you saw some of this in Vietnam as well, but you were not allowed to cross. I mean, you were bombing targets in North Korea, but particularly the fighter pilots.
We couldn't cross the yellow.
Okay, so if I'm engaged with a MiG and I've just got him in my sights and I'm good to go, if he bugs out across that parallel, I have to let him go. That was the official.
The official word was it.
Okay, and I'm sure on occasion nobody ever crossed that line, correct? Is this one of those questions I shouldn't
afraid,
ask?
I'm afraid they did.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And that gun camera and film
Gun camera film proved it.
Okay, all right. Well, so you now... Tell us, was there? You were talking a little bit about some of the missions, and let's transition a little bit here. Okay, well, I'm sorry, I wasn't looking at the screen, folks. We've got two callers here. Let's go ahead and do that if you don't mind, General. Let's first go to Mark. Mark has a question for you about Robinson Reisner. Mark.
Yeah, I first I want to say you have a fantastic radio voice here, and you should be doing this a lot, sir.
So, yeah, he's talking about you, General, not me.
Yeah, right.
Hey, thanks, Mark. You're a pal.
Too, right? Yeah. But anyway, no, the guest gets the priority always. But I was wondering, because I believe that Rob Reisner flew fighters in Korea, and I was wondering if you ever came across him.
Right. I have met Robbie, yes.
And, and the reason I ask is that my first day in the Air Force, I mean, this is like the first absolute, you know, hours I was in the Air Force, they had a table set up with POW bracelets, and I wandered down the rows of them there, and I thought that his name had a neat ring to it. That was the only thing that really picked it out. So I had Rob Reisner's POW bracelet my whole Air Force career until they were brought back, and then fortunately I had also worked at Wright-Patterson, and I actually got to meet him at an event we had. So that was pretty cool.
Robbie was a great fighter pilot, and an image that all pilots respect because of his conduct during his capture and being a POW, plus his air qualities.
He seemed like the kind of guy we couldn't have picked better.
No,
but anyway, my other question to you was going to be just a quick follow up. Here was that you know when they found a B-29 up in Greenland, I think it was there, and tried to rescue it. Did you feel a real pain in the side when they burned it up?
I saw that. What bothered me there, having been an aircraft maintenance guy in the latter part of my years and running depot maintenance, was after all the work they put in that airplane, to have it burn on the ramp.
Yeah, I know. Right, it's too bad.
I mean, any airplane that you destroy is it's got a soft spot.
That's right. Anyway, well, thanks for being on the show, and And I really appreciate listening to you.
Well,
here.
Thank you.
We'll go back to the radio.
Thank you for your interest.
Yeah, and hey, Mark, thanks for your call to American Warrior, but also thank you for your service to our country. We also have Tom calling in. Tom wants to know, General, how do you handle fear in combat? So, Tom, you want to address the general directly?
Yes, General, how do you suppress your fear when you're being shot at?
You suck it up. Basically, the first couple times to be honest with you, the first couple of times you're awestruck by the especially if it's heavy flak or missiles being fired at you. But after about the seventh, eighth mission, while we were counting flak batteries on the ground to see who was firing at us. And so it's one of those things, it's a conditioning thing that, you know, once you've tried it, it's easier the second time.
You know, sir, I've heard someone, I don't know whose quote it is, says that anybody who tells you they're not afraid in combat is a liar or crazy. So
exactly right.
You'd second that.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Well, Tom, hope that answers your question. Thanks for your call to American Warrior.
Thank you.
Now, General, transition here as we go into the next phase of the interview. From B-29s to B-52s, after Korea, then we had another little kerfuffle in Vietnam, and you were involved with the B-52s. What the main is, I look at the bomb loads as we go through these aircraft. Mm-hmm. You know, a B-52 is now carrying 54,000 pounds of bombs. To compare that with a B-17 in World War II, they only carried 20,000 pounds of bombs. So you're talking a significant
quantum jump,
order of magnitude as far as the ordnance they can drop.
The D model with the external racks would carry 108 500 pounders.
And you flew B-52s as well during the Vietnam?
Right.
During Arc?
I flew some of them, but I was on the ground in the Arc Light business, which was the B-52 bombing, as an air operations officer with MACV. I worked for General Westmoreland and then General Abrams, and briefed them every morning and every evening, and they actually picked the targets.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Hey, Dave, Dave, we got a call from Dave, and General, he's got a question here that plays really into what we want to get to later in the show, but this is the guy that answered for you. Dave, what's your question for General Laughlin?
Well, good morning, gentlemen. General, I want to know how we're going to do this. General Eisenhower warned us of the military-industrial complex in 1961 when he left the office. We now have a military that's the greatest in world history. We have to maintain 700 bases around the world. We as a nation are going in debt to maintain this empire. The U.S. military is the largest consumer of oil on the planet. Now, how are we going to do this, sir?
How are we going to do it? I think you've seen the indications that we've scaled down. The Air Force's active duty is down around 313,000 people right now. When I retired in 87, it was upwards to 800 category. And much of that activity has been taken over by the Guard and the Reserve. And, in fact, in most cases, when you're on a base or in Iraq or wherever, you can't tell a Guard guy from an active guy. So they've integrated so well, and that is the only way that we can do it. It's tough when you're dealing with numbers to probably please everybody. But at the same time... to me, I look at it as one, you have life insurance, probably. I look at it as life insurance. Every missile, every airplane is life insurance. And for this country and the security of it. So I would answer it that way.
Okay, well, here's the numbers I'm concerned with. We have 700 bases worldwide. The only other nation that even comes close to that is England and Germany, I think France. And they have maybe 12. Mm-hmm. And there's only... 8 nations worldwide that have bases on other countries. So the numbers here are way out of proportion, and I think go right to the concern of General Eisenhower of the large military-industrial complex. We are there, sir.
Well, I'd say that you have a problem with the administration, then.
There you go. Hey, Dave, thanks for your call. And if you're the Dave I'm thinking of, thank you for your service to our country as well. And stay tuned. We're going to talk a little more about this subject at the close of the program. Sir, this is just, I told you the time was going to fly by. We're going to take another break for the weather, not the news and uniform, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by General Earl O'Loughlin here on American Warrior. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome back to American Warrior. We're joined today. We're just really, really fortunate to have General Earl O'Loughlin, retired four-star general in the Air Force. We've been talking about his 36 years in the Air Force, and just, I got to tell you, I'm relatively new to this radio thing, but it always frustrates me that we just don't have enough time with folks like you, General. So let's skip forward, if you don't mind, to a period that, as you and I both agree, folks don't think much about, and that was the Cold War, the war that kind of wasn't a war, but people were dying. People were being shot down. And when I was reading your resume, it talked a little bit about the RB-47E. And I'd have to be honest with you, I had not even heard of this aircraft. And I started doing some research about it, and I learned about some of the reconnaissance missions that took place early on in the Cold War. So tell us about that aircraft and some of the intriguing missions that they were involved in before pre-U-2 spy plane.
Yeah, the RB-47E was basically a B-47B with a longer nose, which contained cameras. We had forward-looking cameras. We had side-looking cameras. We had a 100-inch in the bomb bay camera, which we could read a license plate from 35,000 feet. And for the technology in that particular time, when you consider it was analog and not digital, it was a pretty forward piece of equipment. It because of the slickness of the nose and no wing tanks, it was about 2.2 Mach faster than a standard B model. So you could run up to 9.98 Mach at high altitude and just about outrun anything that was made in anybody's inventory at that time. So it was an ideal aircraft to make penetrations of different places that you wanted to gain the actual photos of what was going on the ground. That was, you know, far away from GPS and satellites and everything else.
And I think that's important for folks my age and younger in particular to remember is these were the days when you couldn't just have a satellite fly over and snap some convenient photos. Mm-hmm. You actually had to physically go into the enemy territory and run some camera film.
Right. And bet on clear weather.
Well, there you go. Now, there was one mission that I see a lot of references to where correct me if I'm wrong, but again, the mission was to identify the status, I think, of some Russian bombers, but also to look for, there's the MiG-15, and as I understand it, the orders were if you fly at this altitude, at this speed, you don't have to worry about the MiG-15, they can't get to you. And these folks flew this mission, and next thing you know, here comes this plane up to engage them, and it was a MiG-17, which we weren't really. That was a surprise, an unpleasant surprise.
Yeah, the 15, we could watch their contrails as they came through the cold atmosphere, and that's what we sought out from an outside air temperature gauge in your airplane, from minus 29 to minus 49, is the limit of the contrails. And they, at minus 29, they'd be persistent, non-persistent, like you see on a day-to-day basis. They're puffy. If as you got into the colder weather, the air, they would be persistent, the steady streak across the sky. So we would seek an altitude that didn't have those temperatures, and maybe climb, or maybe mostly climb, or in some cases you might want to descend. So you could sit there in the cockpit and watch the MiGs come up. And they would draw contrails as they came up, so you just applied power and climbed to 49,000 feet to escape them because they couldn't get that high. And you'd watch them stall out and go back to their base. The problem with the 17 was what we found out they were practicing, and on several occasions tried it, was they had a higher altitude capability and speed. They would climb to altitude, dive, put their nose down, dive, and launch a rocket on the upturn of a pull up,
so almost kind of a slingshot sort of a
slingshot
concept.
Type thing. Now the problem that was the accuracy of it was only as good and maybe a lot of luck involved. But we didn't lose any airplanes that way. But,
now, sir, this is I've been looking forward to this ever since I knew you were coming on the program because in your bio. It talks about you being awarded a Distinguished Flying Cross by another one of my great heroes, General Curtis LeMay, who's just an Air Force legend.
Right.
But that award took place in a private ceremony. So are you able to tell us, and that's one of those things, folks, are you able to talk about that now and tell us about that mission?
Most certainly. General LeMay executed each and every mission. And I found out going through when we were called to Washington a few years back to have a seminar on past experiences. And we found out that not only did General LeMay approve them, but General Eisenhower approved every sortie.
Individually.
Individually.
Wow. Now there's a particular, and again reading, there's a fellow by the name of John Lapo, and I kind of liked it. One thing I've learned as a civilian is you go into a room and as the story goes, there's a bunch of pilots in the room. You ask them who the best pilot is, and they all raise their hand. But you had some glowing praise for a fellow by the name of John Lapo. Tell us about him.
John Lapo is a Michigan boy like I am, and he came from Grand Rapids, strong family, and. He's small in stature and big in heart and courage.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the missions that John was on, of course, he got more notorious in the Strategic Air Command for having flown under the Mackinac Bridge in a B-47. But we knew John as one hell of a pilot. And he circled the target over Mother Russia. And did about 360-degree turns until the cloud cover cleared the target, and then he took the pictures and moved on out. And General Hewitt Wheelis, was a division commander who resided at one time down here in Tubac until he passed away. Was the division commander stood up and officially reprimanded John in front of all the squadron pilots. And when he got done reprimanding him, he says, "That's done. Now, John, I just wish I had a hell of a lot more just like you."
Well, again, keep in mind, we were not officially at war.
No.
This was not a bombing. Not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
You get in, you get out. This guy's actually circling. Holy cow.
Yeah, and which was a no-no at the time. But knowing John, his follow-on under the bridge business, I mean, he was that. If you wanted a bomb on a target, give it to John.
You know, and sir, there's a quote here that you were speaking to a group, and you said, "John Lapo is one of the finest pilots I've ever known.
Yeah.
If there had been a war, you could have relied on John to hit Moscow, even if his radar was out."
That's right. He'd have delivered it downtown.
And how tall is the Mackinac Bridge?
About 500 feet to the span. Yeah.
And
there was room under it, but it's a no-no.
I can imagine. Yes. Okay. Well. Okay. So what, sir, as we kind of transition into the next, the last segment, I'd like to spend talking about given your history and your expertise and your time, kind of talking about the preparation and where you see our nation standing right now. You're sort of referring back to Dave's call, but it's thinking about folks like yourself and John Lapo, the men and women still serving now, it's been my experience, they still show that kind of gumption, that kind of expertise. Mm-hmm. I guess I don't know nowadays if a general would reprimand you publicly and then make those comments, because the political world is different. But what is your sense leading into the next segment? What is your sense of where we stand today?
Well, the culture's changed.
Okay.
You know, and we've had a lot of social programs thrust upon us that have changed that culture. And I won't go into that if it's okay.
Right, right.
You're
talking specifically about the military culture.
Yeah.
Okay.
The culture has changed. And needless to say, the administrations affect some of that culture. The social things that are thrust upon the service makes it change. I don't think it's affected the guts of the Air Force. There's still people that are dedicated to do what they do and do it right. And they're going to respond to what's needed.
In your time serving and commanding people, what did you, are you able to put your finger on while you were still active duty, where you started to see that change, or did that all start to take place after your career, after you retired?
Looking back, it took place, the major changes have taken place in the last 6-7 years.
Wow.
To be honest with you.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Listen, folks, we have some time with the general. If you want to call in and ask him a question, 751-1041. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. American Warrior will be right back.
She's a good girl. Loves her mama. Loves Jesus.
My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. If you want to support them, start with WoundedWarriorProject.org. Now, back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
And we're back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Just another peach of a show with General Earl O'Loughlin, a retired four-star general, 36 years in the service of our country, involved and experienced so many things. We just don't have time to talk about it. One of the things, but you didn't stop serving when you left the Air Force. You're still very involved in helping young people, General, who would like to get involved in a military career. And, Paul, you have a question for the General about that.
Yeah, a couple of comments. In Korea, I was flying the P-4Ms. We were doing a similar mission to what he was doing. It sounds like. Is he familiar with the Navy P-4M squadrons?
No, I wasn't. The A-3D was as close as we got with the Marines, and but I have heard that, and it may have your organization may have been there ahead of us when the daylight bombing was going on at night. It was strictly night fighters. That's when the A-3D and the F-94 came in.
Yeah, we were there before the A-3Ds, but we were all painted black, if you know what I mean. But
yeah.
I have a question about your assessment of the academies right now. I totally disagree with you. I know plenty of people's kids and grandchildren that have gone there, and they seem to think that it's bastions of feminism now, and where they used to teach science and engineering. Now they teach the same things they do here at ASU, and there's actually no point even having the academies anymore.
Well, you're right in the fact that the curriculums have changed. When I was a young contender at West Point, if I wasn't an engineer, I was lousy in math, there was no way I could get through that place. Now you can take history, biology, a whole curriculum of courses that are similar to universities. I won't say that the academies are useless because we do develop a culture within the Air Force of military discipline and regulations that makes those young people very adept to stepping in and taking over and assuming responsibility. I'd hate to lose that myself.
Paul, well, I don't know what we'd be losing. Our feminine assaults have gone up about 500 or 600% in the past 5 or 6 years, and we're spending millions of dollars on courts because some guy flipped a girl with a towel, and the Air Force generals don't seem to care.
Well, they do care. There again, social experiments that have been forced on the academies have not all worked. And when you put young men and women with raging hormones and place them together, things are going to happen. But the discipline has got to be the factor. And if you have enough discipline and enough examples of being thrown out or disciplined properly, I think you could put a lot of that down, and I think that's where we fail.
And, Paul, thanks for your call to American Warrior, and thanks for your service to our country and the United States Navy. And, General, I want to echo your sentiments. I've had the pleasure of interacting directly with several general officers in the last couple of years, and I will say absolutely they do care. I mean, they're absolutely engaged, and they this is their family. They're concerned about it, and they don't want
– it's you're stepping on my feet when you say that.
Sure. Now, it's interesting. You talk about discipline. You said something that General LeMay, I wrote it down here, a quote General LeMay was talking about or mentioned in a certain incident, and he said, relate to that when he said the guy was unlucky. And tell us what General LeMay said about that.
Well, after a briefing where the wing commander lost an airplane, the vice commander at SAC said, well, you know, General, this guy's just unlucky. And he says, I find a fine difference between unlucky and incompetent. Fire him.
There you go.
And I can remember that having been raised in SAC most of my life, the 25 years or so, fear is a good four-letter word. because it ensures discipline. And if you step out of bounds, you're going to get nailed. Unfortunately, we've gotten away from that in many cases.
And I want to remind our listeners, if you've been following the news, we just lost four airmen over just off the coast of England in an accident. And the business that our men and women in the military are involved with is a very, very dangerous business, even if somebody's not shooting at you. And discipline is absolutely key to helping avoid. And, yeah, you know, sometimes, as one of our previous guests said, stuff happens.
Yeah.
But discipline, whether you're on a mission, a combat mission, or just out there doing training, is absolutely key.
Yep, that's now, true.
Mr. General, one thing I wanted to express to you, we first met out at AMARC recently for the destruction, I'll call it. I think that's the only appropriate
word
for
it. It's a good word.
Of the last B-52G under the START Treaty. And you were a guest speaker at that, and it struck me because I could see and hear the emotion in your voice in the loss of that aircraft.
Yeah.
What... people talk about we're going to, pretty soon there won't be pilots and planes anymore. And as a civilian, I find that crazy scary. But what are your thoughts on the Air Force, our Air Forces moving forward?
I think as we take a look at what's happening, we may be looking at the F-35 as the last manned fighter. That is scary. If we have a bomber in... that's under design at the present time, that if funded will replace the aging B-52s, the B-1s, and the B-2s, which we don't have very many of, that could be unmanned. I lived in a world where recall was one of the greatest things we had.
Explain a little more about that.
Well, I'll give you an example. The Cuban Missile Crisis, we launched the SAC force.
Okay.
Orbited places like Jacksonville, Florida, Homestead, Florida, the Keys, and ready to go in when we were recalled. And then we were dispersed, and we all had nuke weapons aboard. We were ready to... we flew so many sorties, if we dropped a rock on each one, we could have covered the island, probably. And but at the same time, you have the ability to recall your people in if things change, and they changed considerably in the Bay of Pigs and President Kennedy's decisions. But to rely solely on technology and a guy in a trailer steering an airplane in another country, I'm not ready to accept it yet. As a total force.
You're the expert. I'm not. Yeah. I'm just a guy who reads a lot, and I have to agree with you. No matter how good our technology gets, I'm concerned about you just can't replace that human factor.
No.
I had the pleasure of spending some time over at the 7th Bomb Wing recently at Dyess and was able to crawl up into a B-1 that had just come back from overseas. And one of the most beautiful aircraft.
I flew the B-1 at Dyess.
I love that plane, but getting up inside of it, cramped, hot, dirty. I mean, it was almost like the weapons officers. It was like sitting in a capsule. And it was, I remember sitting there, and the pilot who was giving me the tour of the aircraft pointed out that there was still a button there labeled nuke. And it sent a chill down my spine.
Yeah.
Having an operator or that electronic communication versus someone actually flipping the switch is
when we notoriously build bombers to carry bombs and not crew members, we put them in as an afterthought. when it comes to cramped space. Yeah.
Well, and that's, folks, if you haven't had a chance, if you appreciate aircraft, I want to encourage you. We have got one of the best museums in the world here out there at the Pima Air and Space Museum. And go out there and crawl up inside or take a peek inside one of those, even those World War II era bombers, and imagine 11, 12 people up inside that that little metal tube. It really speaks to, and again, coming back to the B-1s, I can't imagine being, those men were, 18, 20 hours airborne, or I don't know, I mean, a long time in that cramped little space, and God bless
them. Well, the B-52, we flew 24-hour overhead missions over the North Pole, over the Mediterranean, patrolled Chrome Dome, Hardhead, Butterknife, all those missions that we flew for 24 hours. With nukes aboard on the periphery of the Russian radar, and that was the Cold War.
And
every day.
And thank God for you never asked to actually launch that weapon.
Yeah.
But you were prepared to do so. Now, actually, a good question that raises, sir. When you're training crews, a bomber crew is a bomber crew, or did a crew that was going to be carrying nuclear weapons have to have special training?
Same crew.
Same crew.
Conventional,
just a matter.
Or nuke, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, I tell you, that it just goes to show. I tell you, would you be willing to come back on sometime and chat
Certainly.
With our listeners? Because
yeah.
there's so many stories here.
Sure.
And one thing I wanted to get to, we didn't touch on, but we've got just about 3 minutes left here. Talk about the B-1 bomber. As I understand it, you were involved in the development of that aircraft.
I was in the on the logistics side.
Okay.
Of maintaining it, and
okay.
And I did get to fly it. It was a natural airplane for me to transition to because of the I had a lot of time on the FB-111, which was a switchblade Edsel and the swing swing wings, and it was just it flew beautifully. A lot of the characteristics of the 111 were in the B-1. It was just bigger,
mm-hmm.
and the bombing platform was a no-brainer. It results of live drops out in the desert, and in the desert is a flagpole where the center of the target is, and many times the chute from the bomb would be draped over the flagpole.
Oh my gosh!
It's so accurate.
That is accurate,
yeah.
And they can cover a lot of territory in a short period of time.
With air refueling, they can go, and they're a 1.5 Mach airplane, and that's about equivalent.
What is the future of the B-1?
I think we'll probably keep them until they make a decision on this the new evolutionary bomber or whatever it is. And in the depot system, you can keep the life of the airplane for damn near ever. We have a joke I made out there was the fact many times we jacked up the tail number and ran a new airplane under it, because by the time we repaired everything on it, it was basically a new airplane.
General, thank you so much for your service, and thank you for sharing your thoughts and your stories and with our listeners. I would just love to have you back, sir, if you'd be willing to do so.
Ben, it's my pleasure. It's been fun.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been American Warrior, another great show. You see what you get when you tune into American Warrior. We'll be right back with another segment of Daily Mail. Thanks for tuning in, folks.